Breadbox Media programming is brought to you by introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
And welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I am your host, Cy Kellett. On December 8th, composer Frank LaRocca's brand new Mass of the Americas will premiere at San Francisco's Cathedral of St. Mary of the Assumption. Had you been there in the early stages of LaRocca's composing career, you almost certainly would not have foreseen that such a work would ever emerge from his pen. Once an acclaimed young modernist, LaRocca is now recognized as one of this country's finest composers of choral music, liturgical music, other forms of other more traditional forms. His CD, In This Place, from Enharmonic Records, reached the top 10 in classical CD sales on Amazon and was a 2013 Critics' Choice at American Record Guide. Reviewing In This Place, the guide said LaRocca has certainly found his distinct voice, drawing upon influences as diverse as Byrd, Mahler, Stravinsky, George Crumb, and Arvo Pärt, he has achieved a wholly original artistic synthesis. The reviewer went on to say, the net impressions are of luminous sacred introspection, transcendental effect, and breathtaking beauty. Now the composer in residence at the Benedict XVI Institute for Sacred Music and Liturgy, LaRocca is also a 2018 winner of the American Prize Competition for Opera and Theater for A Rose in Winter, The Life of St. Rita of Cassia, a major work for chorus, orchestra, and soloists. Composer and critic Mark Nowakowski has said that LaRocca deserves to become a household name amongst Catholics who realize the vital and ultimately inseparable connection between truth, goodness, and beauty. So we thought we'd do our part to help that process along. Frank LaRocca, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
So when did you receive the commission for the Mass of the Americas, and how do you go about writing your first Mass?
Well, I got the commission at the beginning of June in 2018, which is a little bit short notice for these things. Since the Mass itself comprises 11 different movements, once you take all the different parts of the Mass together, it was really pedal to the metal once I got the commission, and I am just today finishing up some very last-minute revisions of it.
So is this something you had thought of doing before, writing a Mass, or how do you, what's your approach?
Well, so actually, it's not my very first Mass.
Oh, okay.
The very first Mass I wrote was a polyphonic choral, very traditional, and indeed I wrote it for a traditional Latin Mass celebration back in 2010, shortly after I returned to the Catholic Church after many, many years away. I dedicated it to the priest at my parish, St. Margaret Mary, in Oakland, California, who kind of guided me in those early days. And that Mass, by a very happy coincidence, was sung for the first time at a Mass at what was Bishop and Bishop Lotland Cordiglione's first solemn pontifical high Mass.
Wow.
And so he got to hear it. Other members of Father Moreau's order, maybe order is not the right word. Father Moreau is a priest with the Institute of Christ the King, Sovereign Priest, which is an institute that serves parishes around the country who desire the traditional Latin Mass. And so this was Father Moreau's farewell Mass, and that's why they sang my Mass, and that's how my relationship with now Archbishop Corleone of San Francisco first got off the ground. And so over the years, the Archbishop, who has a very keen interest in music and, in fact, is a musician himself, having played quite a bit, especially during his high school days. We've had many discussions about music in general, specifically about liturgical music. Back in 2012, when he was still bishop in Oakland, he commissioned me to write a communion motet for the Mass celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Oakland Diocese. And then even after he moved to become Archbishop of the San Francisco Archdiocese, we got together for various occasions, either on purpose or just, you know, accidentally ran into each other at events, kept up this conversation. Therefore, when the Benedict the 16th Institute for Sacred Music and Liturgy is the fruit of something that the Archbishop has long been interested in, finding ways to elevate the celebration of Holy Mass. When the Institute finally got off the ground after a few years of planning, this would have been in October of 2017, I was, over time, brought in to consult on various things and then eventually named their composer in residence at their board meeting in May of 2018. And almost immediately afterwards, the Archbishop came forward and asked me if I would compose this Mass of the Americas. Now, it's a fascinating project because it attempts to bring together, and I hope it will be successful at doing this, musical traditions from what we might call the high church music tradition of polyphonic choral music, people like Palestrina, Victoria, which is, in a certain respect, my main occupation and pursuit as a composer. Not that I'm merely doing a pastiche of those styles, but that's sort of the ground, the foundation from which I work. Mm-hmm. Bringing together that tradition with a tradition that is revered and beloved of many in the Mexican Catholic community throughout the country, and also here in San Francisco, which is music that kind of sits in an interesting middle ground. So tunes like Las Mañanitas, which is what traditional Mexicans sing traditionally to one another as their version of Happy Birthday, but whose text actually originated in a psalm text relating or pointing out the relationship between the Virgin Mary and King David. Likewise, another very popular tune that sits in this kind of middle ground between popular tune and religious or devotional music is La Guadalupana. Most people who are familiar with La Guadalupana would be familiar from mariachi-like performances. That is, it would be heard in a popular setting. It would be performed with guitars and violins and two singers, the way that so much mariachi is. But it is a text which speaks of devotion to Our Lady of Guadalupe. the Marian apparition that eventually converted the Americas. And so the Archbishop, seeing these two, seeing the Our Lady of the Immaculate Conception, sort of the broader Latin or Catholic Church's, Universal Church's vision of the Virgin Mother, together with Our Lady of Guadalupe, he wanted me to compose a mass that would blend these two musical traditions to show the unity of devotion between European and Central or Mexican American culture.
Hence the December date kind of does that for you, December 8th, because you're so...
Well, yes, and by a very happy coincidence, the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is a major mass and feast in many churches throughout California and wider southwest in the United States and certainly in Mexico, happens to coincide this year with the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. And so the premiere of this Mass on December 8th, which is called a Mass of the Americas in honor of Our Lady of Guadalupe, is going to present a sung Mass with instruments. It has a choir, string quartet, organ, guitar. For one special number, it also has marimba. The task that the Archbishop set for me was to find a way for this more popular devotional music of the Mexican in the Mexican traditions to kind of cross the threshold, if you will, of the high Latin church musical tradition, and to essentially merge with it in a way that maintains the sacredness of the music and the decorum of Holy Mass, and yet would every now and then, a wisp of a tune, or even in some places, a more sustained arrangement of one or more of the tunes that I mentioned, would be readily recognizable to the many, many Mexican Catholics who will be attending this Mass on December 8th.
And I don't actually know, will when you do a performance of a Mass, is it a performance, or is it in the context of the Mass that the music is presented?
Good question, because many of the more elaborately composed masses that many of us hear are actually intended more as works for the concert stage than they are works for actual liturgical use. This is intended as a liturgical use composition. And so, for example, the Kyrie at the beginning involves cantor and congregation in a responsorial give and take. So do a number of the other movements in Mass. And then it also has a couple of movements, such as the Gloria and a couple of others, that resemble more that high classical style that you might hear at a concert, but I don't go on and on. I don't have, a 25-minute Gloria. It's a 5.5-minute Gloria. But it's intended not to accommodate congregational participation, but rather to take advantage of the very fine quality of the musicians who will be singing at this event.
So you trained as a young man at Yale University, at the University of California, Berkeley. You were trained in really a modernist kind of music. And I'm wondering what would that guy, that young man that comes out as a modernist, kind of got some acclaim early on, writing modernist pieces, what would he have made of the music you write now?
That young man would not recognize me.
Oh.
At least, well, certainly musically, he would not recognize me. I'll try not to go on long with this answer. Let's say that the man who I thought I was when I was in college would not recognize who I am today. But there's an essence that we all have. There is, you know, who we are in our souls. And the more introspective and thoughtful aspects of that young man back in college and grad school might recognize the fruition of things that were that inklings that I had back in those days, mm-hmm. but which remained sort of hidden behind a very foggy ambiguity, particularly as it related to those days, any firm belief in the existence of the triune God. I didn't explicitly deny God's existence, but I just had not, after my Catholic upbringing, in which I was well catechized, at least until I was about 10 years old. But I became a teenager, I went to college, the whole deal, and my sense of belief in God just slipped away eventually.
And that, I suppose that's a relatively common story in the modern American landscape, is the young...
Yeah, I think it is, especially when you... your listeners realize this is happening to me in the 1960s and 70s, when just everything was being blown to pieces.
Well, I have to
culturally.
Say, I don't have a much understanding of what the modernist composer is attempting to do. How do you, when you're writing that music. Is it an intellectual exercise entirely? Is it a critique of other kinds of music? What is the modern composer doing?
Well, that's a very astute question, because you hit on two essential aspects of modernism. One is its very, very highly intellectual content, and the other is its at least implicit, if not overt, critique of the music of the past. It is largely an attempt at negation.
Mm-hmm.
It's born in the first decade of the 20th century, so it's kind of the intellectual stepchild of, people like Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm.
And it attempts to demonstrate that the hierarchical arrangement of musical tones that had been around at least as long as we can trace the existence of music, going back to the era of the Chaldees, not to mention, the Greeks and then the Jews, early Christians, all the way through the two millennia after the birth of Christ. It attempts to strip the musical tones of any kind of hierarchical relationship, which leads to a potentially chaotic arrangement of the tones. so that tones, when they form melodies, do not seem to follow any kind of sequence that the ear can naturally perceive. And especially when the tones combine into harmonies, they just clash and fail to transcend the sum of their parts, unlike hierarchical tonal music, in which when the tones blend into harmonies, it's almost a triune kind of phenomenon. You have three tones, yes, but you have one harmony unified. And so it undermines that. Now, in order for the music to acquire any kind of order at all, it therefore has to be imposed by intellectual means. And this was the idea behind the creation of what some people may have heard of 12-tone music. The 12-tones technique of composition, which through purely intellectual means establishes a completely arbitrary ordering of all the white and black notes that you would find, you know, in a typical piano, and then uses that for one composition, throws that away, comes up with a new one for the next composition, throws that away, comes up with a new one for the next composition. So there's no continuity except in the most abstract sense. And the music that uses these materials doesn't attempt to do so with a traditional sense of phrasing and form. It also attempts to undermine the grammar, the rhetoric, if you will, of music. And so unless you've been trained to understand this music, it's very likely that when you hear it, you'll just, you know, unless it's, you know, sort of the backdrop for something like Hitchcock's Psycho, where the movie Psycho, where that kind of music actually works very well, just as a listening experience in itself, it leaves most people cold, if not feeling downright cheated. But that's what all the students studying music in academic institutions starting in the 1950s and in some places continuing to this day, although it really has not continued to exert the same monopoly that it used to. That's what we were taught to do. And anything other than that meant that we were intellectual lightweights, that we were retrogrades, and we were assured that we would not in any way be able to pursue successful careers as composers and academics in music if we did not adopt this language and style.
It sounds, the way you describe it, more like an indoctrination than an education in music.
It was completely. And it had a lot of the characteristics of indoctrination, which is that there was any attempt to question it was met with, like I say, it was... They didn't attempt to bend the system itself. Instead, they questioned what was wrong with you for not believing it, you know, which is a typical totalitarian tactic.
So
I don't want to leave the impression that my teachers were bad people, because they were not. They were wonderful teachers, wonderful men and women, but they were captive to this ideology, and. That was the result.
And this takes you a good part of your life to overcome and to discover your music.
Well, yeah, because not only... So in those years when you're studying this style, you have to not only learn that, but you have to kind of unlearn the more natural music tastes and preferences that you developed as a child and as a teenager, which in my case was a mix of jazz and classical and, of course, rock and roll. You have to unlearn that. I've likened it sometimes to well, something that, that happened to my mother. So my mother, you know, back in the 1920s, she was born left-handed. Her parents, they were peasants, not educated, superstitious, and like many people in those days, they forced my mother to become right-handed because if you were left-handed, there was something kind of creepy about that. I'm convinced that for her whole life, my mother always felt like there was something not quite right about some of her internal wiring, because she was forced to unlearn her natural left-handedness in order to become a righty. And it's a bit like that with the music. You have to, you not only have to learn something new, but you have to unlearn the old thing. And if it's deeply ingrained, it's never, well, certainly in my case, it's never going to disappear entirely. And so vestiges of it always kind of remained in my musical subconscious and exerted power over me. And so as a result, I found myself kind of split down the middle, neither fish nor fowl. I was only for a very brief time sincerely committed to modernism. But of course, I had to stay in my creative life and in my academic life committed to it in order to maintain my academic position. But deep inside of me, when I went to compose, I really actually didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something that tapped into my more deep-seated tastes and desires.
So it strikes me that if, as you're, say, graduating from Berkeley, you have lost your Catholic faith and you've lost the the thread of music in this modernist kind of ideological music. Is the recovery of your spiritual life, your Catholic faith, and the recovery of music for you, are these things that happen in parallel? Does one lead to the other? How did that happen for you?
Wow, excellent question. I'm usually asked the question, what influence did your returning to the Christian faith? Because actually, when I came out of my agnosticism / atheism, it wasn't directly into the Catholic Church. It was first as an evangelical Protestant or a sort of evangelical Presbyterian, if that's not an oxymoron. And some people people have often asked me what effect did returning to the Christian faith have on your music? And I used to give an answer, but you know, as time has gone by, and I've looked back at the days prior to my returning to the practice of any kind of religious faith, I actually realized that these things were happening in parallel. That in fact, after I got out of grad school and I was teaching, and I was coming in contact with the tastes of my students, which tended not to be too modernist. And I was, you know, I was out of the bubble, so to speak, at least the very intensive bubble of grad school. My own desires as a composer kind of started to try to bubble up to the surface again. And I became deeply conflicted and began to question so many things. They took the form of aesthetic questions. And while I wouldn't have put it quite this way back then, I was asking, what is beauty? And because I was asking, what is beauty, that led me in a almost parallel path to have to consider what is truth. And once I started asking myself that question, I had to start thinking about God. And so I guess you could say that my conflicts about musical style and questions of beauty naturally linked up to questions about truth, and that the two of them in tandem, I guess, eventually led me back to belief in God, but then more fully and finally back to the Catholic faith of my youth. That was about 10 years ago.
We're talking with Frank LaRocca, composer Frank LaRocca. He has a brand new Mass of the Americas that will premiere December 8th at San Francisco's Cathedral of St. Mary of the Assumption. His CD that you should get is called In This Place. You can get it wherever really good CDs are sold. We'll continue our conversation with Frank next week. A lot more to get into, but we wanted to share with you as we close this week's episode of Catholic Answers Focus, a real treat. Off of that CD that we just mentioned, there's a track called O Magnum Mysterium, a piece called O Magnum Mysterium. A Christmas piece, a piece about the incarnation of the Lord in Christ, full of joy and full of maybe a surprising amount of sorrow as well. I think you'll really enjoy this piece. Hang around and have a listen, and then join us next week on Catholic Answers Focus.
Thank you.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.